Committee on the Judiciary, work session, Wednesday, May 9th, 1979, tape 41, side 1. From the committee, the committee of 80 requires four to pass any amendments and five to pass the bill out. We'll do some work with two pretty soon, one way or another, but the reason we're not proceeding yet is there are only two of us. And so we do have some problems today. Two senators are out of town. Another senator is on a conference committee. So we're going to be lucky if we have four, I think. But what we will do if we don't have these four is just have some supplemental information for us to get rid of that information at least. And of course, the other five members of the committee will accept our word for it, right, Senator Smith?
We can amend, Chairman, four to a few others.
No.
Rapidly operate on the
five. Right. Soon as Senator Brown gets that will. We're going to proceed and function as a subcommittee, including the subcommittee amendments. Jim, you want to keep count of this. This is Senator Smith's idea. I think it's a good one. So that we can then have this package, and we'll just get hopefully pro forma approval from the other people. So, let's have 807 is here, and I understand that Glenn Patterson and Mr. Kopp had something more they wanted to suggest to us at this time. Do you have something more you want to suggest, Tom?
And the questioner, I think, had 30 words.
On not on 807, was it? Reading one.
No.
Well, that's another bill.
I'd like to hear an 807 briefly also from me.
Why don't you take that?
Please keep it up and going them if you'd like.
Thank you.
Go right ahead. Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim Hodge. I'm here representing myself and the Seventh-day Adventist churches throughout the northwestern United States. Seated to my right is Glenn Patterson. He is the lobbyist for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We appreciate the opportunity that you've given us in this work session to just make a few extra notes. Number one, Dean Scholes provided language for a substitution in the bill. And we just wanted to be on record as supporting that substitution. I would like to request the committee to consider on line 5 of that proposal, you will find that the Uniform Anti-Mortem Probate Act, as proposed by the Committee on Uniform Laws, or at least as their third working draft, excludes the spouse and descendant from being allowed to be a party to this type of an action. And I would like to suggest to the committee that the descendants be allowed to become a party to this action. However, I think the exclusion of the spouse is extremely appropriate. With that minor additional look, I would heartily support the substituted language there. I want to call the committee's attention to the fact that when the hearing was held on this bill, no one testified against the bill. I would like to advise the committee further that we have just very recently discussed this bill somewhat with United Methodist Church, Emmanuel Hospital, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, University of Portland, American Lutheran Church, the Catholic Archdiocese, U.S. National Bank, Willamette University, and other charities. A consensus feeling among these charities is that there is no opposition. The general feeling is that this could, in fact, be a very useful tool for them, and there could be considerable need. It was quite new to them, and they had, you know, would like, I think, an opportunity to look further at this, but essentially their feeling is that this would be a very advantageous thing, I believe. I would like to further advise the committee that since my testimony here about a week or 10 days ago, that two situations have arisen with regard to my major client, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, in which this bill could have, had it been available in the, you know, several years ago, could have assisted us quite greatly in these situations. One is a deceased doctor who wished to leave everything, or most everything, to a charity, and he has a spouse surviving him who agrees that that was his intent. However, there are children who are unhappy at being left out of the major portion of the estate, and the charity is being placed in a very, very, I think being schools use the word blackmail position. And another one has arisen which has other facts but are very similar. So there is a need for this type of legislation. I would just also like to quote Attorney Eugene Felt, who represents the Catholic Archdiocese in many of their matters. In a discussion that we had yesterday on the phone, he indicated to me that to postpone such an action by the legislature until the next session could involve the Catholic Church in the loss of potentially several million dollars, and it would be just an off-the-cuff estimate of mine that the Seventh-day Adventist Church could be involved in a similar amount of money. And that is the reason why we would like to urge the committee to look very carefully at this bill and possibly recommend it for passage this session. I would like to introduce to you Charles O'Dell and Lloyd Diamond, both of whom are sitting on the back row. Just before the committee convened, I discussed with them the amounts of wills, etc., that they might have, which might be involved in a situation like this. And Charles O'Dell indicated that he has somewhere between 400 and 600 wills that could, in fact, might have been able to utilize this procedure had it been available when they were executed, or even now maybe. And Lloyd Diamond indicates that he has approximately 1,000. In his trust area over which these two men manage for the Seventh-day Adventist Church alone. This is just one small charity in the state of Oregon. Now, these are spread all over the state. So, we would like to urge you to look at this bill and to recommend it for passage. There is a need for it, and I believe that concludes my remarks.
I just like to say I'm Pete Bison, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals. I would like to concur with what Mr. Hoffman had to say, and to tell you that there are a large number of not-for-profit hospitals in this state who do benefit to one extent or another from bequests. And there have been occasions where wills have been challenged and been contested, and it seems to me where a process such as this could establish the testamentary capacity and the freedom from undue influence, that would be a tremendous asset to that charity, to that charitable organization, in defending a will contest. So we would like to support the bill and thank you for the opportunity.
Sure. How would you amend the bill? You want to send it to not the South? I don't understand. Tell me what.
In Dean Scholl's recommendation, or in his draft, excluded from the operation of the bill, you'll see on lines 4 and 5 of the first page, that it's binding all people who might be interested in the estate except the spouse and the descendant. I'm not sure what the Uniform Committee, why they wanted to exclude those except for the fact that it was it might generate intra-family difficulties during the lifetime of the testator. I believe that's especially valid with regard to a spouse. You wouldn't want a spouse testifying against a living spouse, particularly you wouldn't want to encourage that sort of thing. However, descendants for charities and non-profit hospitals, I would assume, quite often you have a situation where the children are left smaller portions of the estate very, very purposely on the part of the on the part of the parents. Or grandchildren are left out. They're also descendants, lineal descendants. The problem that they're trying to address here is very remote, I think, in regard to the descendants, and yet the descendants are the ones, quite often, together with the collateral, that generally raise the question of undue influence or lack of testamentary capacity. So I would like for you to study the proposition of including the lineal descendants within the scope of this act, excluding the spouse.
How would you learn that?
Well, actually, if you'll just take a moment, I would exclude the two words "and descendants" on line 5. I would exclude on line 26 of page 2 the words "or descendants or both," and on line 28 the words "and without living descendants," and then there would be a couple of grammatical changes in that sentence structure there. Also on page 3, I would omit, under section 3, page 3, section 3, line 9, the last two words of line 9, the entire content of line 10, and the underlined or underscored portion of line 11. And I think that would essentially omit the descendants.
Yes. So moved.
Senator Smith has moved the proposed amendment.
Yes.
In the committee file, we have letters from Judge McClendon and Judge Beatty opposing this bill. And Judge Beatty just walked into the room, but I wonder if it might be appropriate
you have any, Judge Beatty, would you like to comment further on this bill?
Does it affect these amendments?
I think it's opposed to it generally. I should inform the committee that I would favor amending the bill exactly as Judge Scholl has suggested, but I would oppose it and inform that you suggested. I think that I remember talking to former probate Judge Dixon, and who was in it for many years, and I think we were discussing it, and I was involved as the lawyer and witness in one will contest, and this was after that. But Judge Dixon said that will contests usually come when children are omitted. That's when they come. Usually a will contest, well, there are always exceptions, are not initiated by more remote people. And And the reason they are there is because of their biblical and ancestral background. Children simply believe that they're in right, entitled to certain considerations from their parents. And I personally think it would be intolerable to accept your amendment. I think that it's important in defending the family and trying to keep peace to say that someone could bring in and force the children to come in and argue about the competence of their parents. I think that's intolerable. And I personally would not support it. So that's why I would, while I personally might be inclined to support amending the bill, I'm not sure if I would support the bill yet, but at least for them to have it at all, it would be in the form of being a soul excluding the parents and children. That's the way I feel about it. Judge Beatty?
Well, Mr. Chairman, John Beatty representing the Judicial Conference, I sent to the committee on April 20th a brief statement of our position. The thing that we're concerned with is the impact on the docket, probate docket, not only in Multnomah County, but of course in other parts of the state. And our feeling that by and large, this will produce more litigation than it will settle. And I think if a person proposes as a testator or a testator in conjunction with any proposed beneficiary has any concern about whether somebody is going to challenge his capacity or challenge the question of influence, the remedies have been known for generations. You have appropriate medical examination by people whose testimony will be beyond question. You present a question of undue influence. You send somebody to make arrangements for them to consult a wholly independent counsel who can carefully explore it and make a record which is available. And for that reason, we think that the remedies are adequate for dealing with this situation in the present system, and that it's simply premature. It's creating litigation in advance of any demonstrated need for it. So I think that basically is our position on this, Chairman.
Those fears in any way can be supported in the fact that, you know, for example, this statute originally drafted was taken from, I believe, a statute in California or Washington State. I've seen just a few of them, I gather, at least I have no knowledge that sort of litigation has come to pass that you're concerned about.
Senator, statistically, you have no information from California or a comparable state that has done it. Of course, the docket problems are quite different in different states. California, for example, takes much longer to try cases than we do. All we're looking at is we're looking at here the creation of a remedy which does not now exist. And if it creates 2, 3, 4 will contests, for example, in Multnomah County, it will have a demonstrable effect on the probate docket there, which is already running to the point where we have to have a pro tem judge that's sitting with the probate judge a substantial portion of the time. So we're looking at it clearly from an administrative point of view, measuring that against the likelihood of any harm resulting to people and what other alternatives there are for litigation in this manner.
I have to agree with the judge that an increased docket load is not something to be sought after. We propose this bill in the hope that it would, in fact, help the docket load some and preclude the necessity of charities standing up and being counted in the area where a decedent is quite conclusive, as far as the charity is concerned, had an intent to do precisely what the estate plan calls for. But yet, because of the fact that a lawyer can be hired on a contingent fee arrangement to contest the will at no cost to the beneficiary, they have nothing to lose but to raise the question. And so the charity winds up in a situation where if there's any sizable bequest, you're automatically in the area of potential litigation. And it's hoped that this bill would help solve that problem and coincidentally, hopefully, help the docket.
Generally, the one real contest I was involved in, that Leo Levinson ended up trying the case, because I had seen statements from the various people, the contestant was the church. And not so people's relatives.
That casts the church in an awfully unhappy role, I'd have to say.
Okay. Well, that's where we are. Senator Smith, did you want to make your motion again now? I'll tell you, if you would make it to substitute, I would support you on it. To substitute all the amendments without change.
Okay,
the motion is to, for working purposes, to delete the proposed substituted bill, the words in the proposed substituted bill that would allow the pre-death suit to bind defendants. That's the motion by Senator Smith. Does everybody understand the motion? Do you understand the motion, Senator Taylor?
Yeah, he wants the declaratory judgment to be binding on the children.
Right. Okay. You weren't here when we were discussing it, so I wasn't sure what we were talking about.
I don't find believing anything worth fighting over. I'm having a lot of trouble coming up to speed on this bill.
Okay. Chris will call the roll on the Smith proposal.
Brown.
Aye.
Bailey.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Cook.
No. Motion failed. Now I move that we have a across the board substitution of the sole proposal to replace the existing wording. Well, this would provide that you can sue everybody except the spouse and children.
Well, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Four members subcommittee.
Oh, we're a committee now. Right there.
If I leave, you guys win the vote, and if I stay, you lose. Then you lose.
Three votes is better than three.
I'll go out, make your motion again, I'll come back.
No, we're the four winners.
No, we're two.
Don't you lose. We're the committee now, we got a quorum. And what we do is meaningful, we don't have to go through it again.
Who would lose?
We haven't got to go through it all again.
Oh, all right. Well, we did it on your own.
Well, at least two are understandably excused. Senator Ford has been gone for quite a while. Senator Wires, I think, is up in the state. Senator Cruz, that's the other way it is.
Yeah. But Senator Cook, it's hard for me to completely understand the bill. But if you have a bill, it would seem to me that you would want to have one lawsuit instead of two. And so I'd want to bind as many people as possible. While these gentlemen were talking, I was trying to figure out what would happen under our law if your wife dies or you divorce your husband.
and marry again, then all of the wills are revoked anyway, and that lawsuit would sort of be wiped out as far as the wife was concerned in any event, unless we were to change that rule. So we'd never really be able to bind the spouse unless that happened to be the spouse at the time of death, because a change in the condition of the spouse, certainly a new spouse, would revoke the prior will, which was the thing that was contested in the contest. We had a contest over something that was void as the spouse in some circumstances, those factual ones I talked about. But as far as the children's concerned, they aren't going to change. So why not bind them?
I'll tell you why I oppose pre-death binding of a I was going to respond to one of your questions.
Yes, sir.
All right. The reason why I would oppose including the spouse and the children is because a child is going to be put in an extremely bad situation if the father or mother makes out a will leaving the property to someone else. We're not just talking about churches, it could be to your kingdoms, you know. Makes out a will leaving the money. Makes out a will leaving the money to someone and cutting off or eliminating the child's share. Because of the situation between fathers and children. Now, I guess I was thinking of this as I was involved here. My father is dead now. But during his lifetime, my father was committed to another institution at my suggestion. While he was incompetent, he married, supposedly. And I knew he married, and I knew he was under a guardianship. I knew it could be righted. But it was enough of a problem the way it was. Without going through the horrible personal agony of bringing a lawsuit during his lifetime to void a marriage which I knew was wrong and should not have been allowed. But as long as it wasn't hurting him, you had a greater concern for your father, perhaps, than for the state. Now, I've lived through that, and I know what that is, and I think what this proposes is something on a par with that. They're going to come in and they're going to disinherit one of your children. You know, our children want more than anything else is to be loved by their parents, and they may have felt bad about it, and they're probably not going to do anything about it, even though it may be wrong. And I just think that this bill in that form is creating a horrible situation. It's not fair to the children.
Mr. Jones, I have a question.
Yeah.
Why are we arguing about this in the law? Well, I brought it up.
I brought it up.
It was my fault. I brought it up again. And the reason I brought it up was to try to more fully understand both the dynamics on the committee and the testimony I didn't hear.
Well, you heard them now. I mean,
yeah, I'm
not prepared. I said, one thing to add on that from Dean Scholes is testimony and written material. He agrees that the greatest problem that the uniform commissioners identified was trying to make this proceeding somehow a real adversarial proceeding, and that a child or a spouse that goes into it has an interest in being a part of the will, so that they really can't go in full bore
Because the testator may change his or her mind. So he can't go in and say you're crazy. When in fact the they have an interest in the person that made out the will or trying to make out the will while changing their mind. And secondly, the feeling of the uniform commissioners that the real problem with charities involves distant relatives. It didn't involve spouses. So to attack the problem, they don't have to include lineal descendants and spouses. That was at least Dean Scholes' proven goal.
Senator Smith, if you'd allow me one more swipe at beating the dead horse, I want to ask a question along the line of what has been brought up with you're patronizing me. I don't mean to. I'm asking you to patronize me. I don't want to do that either.
Well,
you got it, then I'll just go ahead and see what he would say.
We're
short of time, and that's Smith's point. The thing I don't understand is why isn't what he's talking about entirely possible and potentially lead to an additional lawsuit? If I were setting out to have my will upheld in court during my lifetime, and I had some question about it, I would try to maneuver around that in some way, and one of the potential ways that comes to mind would be to promise the child that was most aggressive and most likely to contest it that after the contest was over, I would leave him something by a gift during lifetime and reward him in that way for not having exercised his legal right to appear in court. And then, you see, I would have conned him maybe into not contesting the decree would be final, and then what he'd have would be an lawsuit to make me carry out my contract. Can't criticize that. Tell me what's wrong with that.
Well, I suppose what you say is fully accurate. I think maybe the situation may be somewhat misconstrued, and I may have made myself misunderstood to the committee. But I think the concept here is to allow a person, a testator, and his lawyer the opportunity to have an additional tool, or the only tool really, to use in a situation where this is worried about by the testator. Not one where a child must be involved. But if the descendants are allowed to be in, then they have the opportunity to be there if they want to be. If you exclude them, then they can't be there, really, because they're not a party. But they can be. And additionally, you mentioned about your father, Mr. Chairman, and you're reluctant to bring action because of your father's state of health. This is exactly the same, only way, way different, in that it's the father or the testator who's going to be asking this litigation to be heard in the first place. So it's the other
lawyer who's going to be in the position of either coming in and saying my father is crazy, or he's going to be bound. I can't believe
that. Or an influence, and I think that's one of the major areas.
That's right, and I just think that's a I think it's wrong to put a child in that position. And you don't have to. That's the way I feel. Difference of point of view. Okay, now I'll move to see what happens with it, that we substitute Soles amendments in the original form for the content of the bill.
I don't understand.
The Soles amendment is...
It says it binds only ancillary beneficiaries and not spouse or direct descendants.
Right.
The direct descendants include grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Yes. I think so, that's what I've always felt.
Did Dean Scholes tell you whether the word presumptive included shows as an action or was limited to real property?
I don't remember him telling you.
Okay.
I was sure if I would have probably known someone else who was here. I was a presumptive. So what he's saying, brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts, if he could name as defendants, would have an interest in this decision, would be those other than who would be his heirs were it not for the fact that he had a wife or children.
This may not be a direct discussion. Assumption this practice, the child is guaranteed a dead gift team. He gets that instead of if you have to kind of, so that he can never be cut out of everything, no matter what the world is. Rather like Ellis Presley. And that was someone else's idea of how to settle this. So he's probably getting more sides of it.
I think that's in Europe, I believe, was the Philip's practice. Cannot cut your child out. Okay, is there any further discussion? Does anyone have any objection to that amendment?
Well, doesn't shoot down the whole bill.
No, I think you'd rather have that than nothing.
All right. Okay. I understand. This is as far as the usual commissioner's got in 20 years.
All right, so is there any objection? There is no objection, the bill is still amended. And that's as far as we can go with it, so probably that's all we're going to do with that bill today.
We appreciate the opportunity to come in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
There may be some technical amendments to how know that uniform act into our statutes. Format. I would assume that motion included those small non-substantive modifications.
Small non-substantive modifications. Do you have any of those in mind?
No.
Including detecting the scale of which there's a lot of students and teams here.
Well, I wouldn't want to be part of that.
You can go ahead, as long as you don't have to redo the, as long as it has to be changed anyhow, you can go ahead and defect it, I guess. Now, I want to get to 6:30, but Senator Gardner, who isn't here, did mention, or he was asked about 8:13. Now, if someone here on 8:13 won't take more than 5 minutes, I'll let you speak now. Otherwise, you need to wait. Okay. We'll go to Senator 6:30.
Senator 6:40, Mr. Chairman, is a bill amending in
poor substantial way the existing experimental drug law. And there are a number of amendments which are in your folder on Senate Bill 640 to the bill as drafted. It might be appropriate first to look at what the bill does. Okay. The first important change, as I see it, is on page 2 of the bill, line 7, limits the use of experimental drugs when the person is not able to give informed consent to drugs for the purpose of diagnosing or treating a particular ailment or problem of that patient. As it stands now, under the present law, you would be able to use experimental drugs on a patient for purposes other than treating that patient's problem. If you were able to obtain consent from one of the patient's relatives, for example, or a guardian. The second major change is also on page 2 at line 15, which provides that in situations where a patient is able to give informed consent, there would be an additional requirement that a nearest relative be informed of the use of that drug and what that drug is all about as far as side effects are concerned, for the purpose of allowing the patient to consult with that nearest relative. It also includes a provision where the patient can waive that for confidentiality. Well, they never say that when the purpose is private. And that would require filing a supplemental form. The third change is of major importance, as I see it, as on page 3, line 11, a new section which would prohibit basically in the nursing home situation, would prohibit someone having an ownership interest in the nursing home from prescribing an experimental drug for a resident patient of that facility.
This is new section 11, isn't it?
Yeah, it's new section 10. And the fourth change would be at the very end of the bill on page 3115. Eliminating the requirement of intent, a culpable mental state, when you're talking about a violation of this act, it would make it a strict liability crime, and the penalty would remain a Class A misdemeanor by law.
Did Senator Smith leave, or is he just outside the door? I'll tell you, my feeling, Senator Brown, is that if you get Senator Smith's approval, would be to delete Section 11. I think that's coming on a little bit strong, don't you think, in making any violation of misdemeanor, even a negligent violation of
I just said research on that question, Mr. Chairman. There are examples of strict liability crimes creeping into the law. They're fairly new. There's been a couple of cases.
We worked on one today.
Well,
the penalty
for parents. Yeah.
The moment you become a parent,
you can't. It's not the law. The Court of Appeals decision, if you wanted to eliminate the word intentional here, you would have to make it very clear in the matter of legislative history that you meant to make this strict liability crime. Otherwise, it would find that what you meant was that this was simply a violation
Because there is a statute, I believe it's chapter 161 or 163, which specifically says that in crimes that are not part of the criminal code, the legislature has eliminated the intent requirement, unless they've done so expressly, to the contrary, it will be found to be a violation as opposed to a crime. So you could either make that an express part of legislative history and put in here that it was a strict liability crime, or perhaps grade the crime according to the state of the mental culpability.
Not sure if you're in Senator Brown, you think we ought to keep that in or take it out? Do you have any feeling?
If I had a better understanding of exactly what the burden we were putting on the medical authorities and how difficult it would be to comply, I would have a more comfortable feeling as to whether I would want to charge them with something that is a Class A misdemeanor for essentially a negligence type violation. So I'm not sure I understand the bill adequately. Jim, you just went over what I gathered was the basic amendments that we find in the bill as it exists.
Right. We haven't gotten to the
amendments. If I could just review this term very quickly, you mentioned on page 2, lines 7 to 9, this requirement of consent. Now, what's the thrust of that?
Okay, the thrust of this has to do with the person who is uttered in the given form of consent.
It's a very senior citizen who is in a state of coma.
Under present law, as I understand it, if they could obtain the consent from the government or from a new resident, they would be able to utilize criminal drugs that do not have anything to do with treating the particular condition of that patient. Under this change, they would be limited to treating that patient's problem.
That is a coma. This is some stricter
right.
Okay, basically, if the person cannot give his own consent, and the consent has to come from the guardian, then the consent is limited to a problem is being treated by the medical institution, which would address the problem the patient is suffering from.
That's correct.
Okay. Not doing bed sores. Well, because that's fine. Okay. That's number one. Number two was the consent situation. That's just notice to that's again. That's a notice situation. And the last major change is the one you mentioned on section 11.
The one just before that on prohibiting cooking the only addition.
No, that's just an unfortunate. Okay. I tend to go along with the Senator Cook that a violation here of a costume, Class A misdemeanor, maybe is a little bit heavy.
Well, have you given me any thought, Bob, on that? We're on 640. I was raising the question about whether or not we should keep in this section 11 in the bill that would say any violation of it would be a misdemeanor, suggesting that I'd be inclined to take that out, as that's putting an almost absolute liability burden on people involved. Do you have any feeling on that area? Well, I'd take it out altogether and leave it the way it is now. It would be an intentional violation.
It's true.
Page 3, line 15.
Could you somehow put the difference? So there is some penal sanctions, but at a much lower level, maybe changes to this into an offense, non-misdemeanor court.
Well, they got an intentional violation, which I think that you would need to.
Well,
it's a
violation of this provision becomes an offense. It's not a misdemeanor, not a felony, but a criminal offense. That's that new breed of cat we've got that comes in here. Jim, could you get that again? You mentioned one.
Yeah, you could along the lines of the gradations of assault find that a unintentional violation created an offense, whereas the intentional violation created a class A misdemeanor, or you could perhaps become more sophisticated and find that certain violations of this, for instance, the deliberate avoidance of the consent requirement of the statute would be something even greater than in class A. You could try to grade it that way.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the language intentional on line 15 of page 3, but that we also provide conceptually that a negligent violation would constitute an offense.
What kind of offense?
A really crime? Negligent. Negligent.
I need your idea to warn you.
That's one of the fields for you.
Yeah. Which is one.
Just take this out altogether and throw the original language.
Which is a personal violation.
Yeah.
You'll never prove that,
Well, I think, they won't do it, probably.
I'll limit my motion just to the restatement of the language intention.
Okay, so the effect of that would be to delete section 11 altogether. So, okay, that's Senator Brown's motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ours. So we got that out. We won't be talking about that anymore.
Is this dealing about something of a lower level?
Nothing.
Now, members, we have Keith Flashman, I think, brought a. Didn't you bring an expert here today that couldn't be here today then? On this bill, so let's have you. And I told him you could bring his expert here at the work session. Would you like to bring some of here and hear your comments?
There are always great expectations, Mr. Chairman, when one of the lobbies says I have an expert.
Mr. Chairman, I have prepared written comments. My name is Elizabeth Patterson, and I'm an attorney. I represent Sisters of Providence in Oregon.
Just a second. Senator Brady, can you hear? Why don't you come up to these chairs up over here, and then you can hear her testimony. Mr. and Mrs. Brady, I think you can hear her better up here. I know you're very interested. Yes, they see you right there. You can hear everything she's saying. Yeah. Okay, now why don't you start over again now? These folks are the sponsors of the bill, so speak loud enough so they can hear you.
My name is Elizabeth Patterson. I'm an attorney, and I represent Sisters of Providence in Oregon. They operate three hospitals in Oregon, Providence Medical Center, St. Vincent Hospital, and Providence Hospital in Medford. I prepared written comments, which are more extensive than any verbal comments that I will give to you here today. I have indicated with headings areas in those comments that speak to various points so that you can, if there's anything you might be interested in looking at further, you can find it easily. Essentially, these summarize the federal regulations that deal with drug experimentation and discuss some of the particular problems that we see with the existing Oregon legislation on experimental drugs and with Senate Bill 640, which amends that legislation. Previously, the Oregon Hospital Association, Oregon Medical Association have presented alternative amendments to the existing legislation, and some of the comments in my written remarks, they go to matters that were addressed in those alternative amendments. I would be glad to answer questions at any time if later on you have more of a chance to look at these and have any questions. I would be glad.
You're going
to
tell us
not
what you think is wrong with the bill,
or? I am. I'm going to also summarize the federal regulations.
Okay.
What
was that?
Procedurally, you have some amendments.
Yes, that one.
That I assume will take care of Christopher's appeal.
I think, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I think it's my own speech question of this, but the Oregon Association has to
approve, Mr. Chairman, that members be told that instead of turning the bill apart, we talk about the amendments that. If you agree to that amendment, and it might save a great deal of time.
You have discussed the amendment and make a deal.
Well, that's fine.
You
tell us about the proposed amendment.
In your very brief introduction, it was suggested at the hearing that the LMA and the LH ought to be doing something constructive that would permit us to work within the bill to get an advantage and make the bill less onerous from our standpoint. So we have suggested or will suggest this amendment in the hope that we'll cut down some of the duplication that we now find to be unnecessary and ineffective.
Do you have that amendment?
No. If I may, I'd like to use it right now, sir. On page one of the bill is introduced, line 11, following the word finished, add or approved, delete the period, add a comma, and insert the following language, providing such form meets the requirements of ORS chapter 475. What that would do really would permit a hospital to make a determination of its own form, which would include those things necessary by federal requirements. We also include all things necessary within the state law, use one form instead of two, and have that form approved by the Board of Pharmacy. We think that would avoid some of the duplication that has been troublesome in the last few years.
And what are the last words that you added would add after pharmacy?
Providing such form meets the requirements of ORS chapter 475.
Okay.
One form instead of two.
Go ahead.
Basically,
that's the only amendment we're proposing.
The only amendment.
Mm-hmm. You agree to the bill.
Mr. Lutz.
Good move, Bob.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
You have Senator Brown?
Keep it down to one form. We have four forms on line 11. That
should
be indicated on
well,
A form or B form.
No, Senator Brown, I think that forms is appropriate there because it could be on one of two forms described and furnished by the Board of Pharmacy or a form approved by the Board of Pharmacy.
Okay.
So
I've moved those amendments.
Mr. and Mrs. Brady, do you have any first exception to that amendment?
Yes, I'm first of all, I'd like to see it written out because I didn't bring my bill, so I should have.
We'll get you a copy of the.
So he would write it out, but I believe that I would be.
Why don't you?
It's written out.
Let me see if I can explain it to you. And if I understand it, then you should be able to understand it. Okay, now, what this would say is that the consent can be given not only as is now on a form furnished by the State Board of Pharmacy, but also it can be given on a form supplied by someone else, approved by the State Board of Pharmacy, so long as it meets the requirements of this section of the law which you were instrumental in having adopted a year ago. Now, isn't that true? Do I say it accurately?
Yes, sir.
So that's the way I understand it.
Each time that we have had a meeting, they have brought a different form, different amendment.
Well, we're talking about this one now.
Oh.
So go ahead and sit down now.
They have been wanting to use the federal and the government form. In the first place, they cannot. The federal and ATW forms are not sufficient. This is why we have a law. Number one, the federal and ATW forms do not set aside the two loopholes in the federal government, which is the one that I've discussed with you here before. On top of it, the ATW forms do not give the name of the manufacturer. They do not give the name and address of the doctor who prescribes the medication. They do not give the name of the doctor who is in charge. And our forms give about 11 things more besides what the ATW forms give. In other words, by doing what they ask, we are right back to where we were when I found and I decided my mother's been experimented on. And I did not know the name of the drug, I did not know the name of the prescribing doctor, I did not know the name of the doctor who was in charge.
Let me back up here. Do you have anyone here from the Board of Pharmacy? Are you familiar, Pete, with the Board of Pharmacy? What I was wondering is, you might.
I would like to speak to the points raised by Mrs. Brady, if I could.
Well, before you do, here was a thought that I had that maybe would resolve that question, and that is, if the State Board of Pharmacy, it has the authority to adopt rules and regulations. Now, if we made it clear that there would be an opportunity for hearing before the approval of the form.
There's one.
On the Board of Pharmacy?
Yes, before these forms were approved, they had a hearing. And all these people came, and Dr. Brady and I testified, and they had the public hearing before these forms were approved.
That's under the present law.
Yes.
All right, so if we were to amend it, as they are suggesting, with the understanding that before they would approve the form of somebody else, that matter would be the subject of hearing. Then wouldn't you have the same result?
No, because you see, the Board of Pharmacy has to follow our bill. In other words, what they put in the law is what is in our bill. And therefore, if you don't have these things that we find were abused in the bill, they can't put it in. Mr. Bayer, I think that the amendment that is proposed here will avoid the problems that were pointed out by Mrs. Brady. First of all, the two loopholes that she mentioned are exceptions to the requirement of firm informed consent must be secured. They don't relate to the form in which informed consent must be secured. And as long as we are just dealing here with the form, it still would have to be gotten on one form or another in every situation where an experimental drug was administered. Those two exceptions would not apply, Mrs. Brady, under this.
I do not agree. And in fact, when I first met with these people, they did not even know that there were the two loopholes, and they even argued with me for quite a while. So they just didn't know it. And I certainly I think you're just destroying the whole bill if you do this now, so you're making exceptions and discrimination. I think there should be one bill and one rule for all.
Mr. Chairman, in my written comments, the exceptions are described in some detail, and I believe that if you look at those, you'll see that they relate to the situations in which informed consent must be secured. So one is for emergencies, is that not right, Mrs. Brady? And the other one is for situations where the doctor believes that it's in the best interest of the patient that informed consent not be secured.
The law reads that human research, the drug investigator must get consent, except if he thinks it's not feasible or if, in his opinion, he does not think that it's best for the patient not to know. And so therefore, he doesn't have to do a thing under those two laws.
What does this bill in its present form eliminate those loopholes?
That's right. But in its present form and with the amendment that was proposed by Mr. Fleischman, this bill would still eliminate those two exceptions. The only thing that we are speaking to in this amendment is the form of the consent. I don't see that they're eliminated.
Okay, we have your point of view now. Please.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the reason for the amendment is to provide one form instead of two. We now have the two forms, the federal and the state. If we can do one form that includes all of the state law and all of the federal law, do it in one form, we cut out the duplication. The amendment is not meant to sidestep anything. It's merely meant to compact the requirements of federal and state into one form, which would be approved by the Board of Pharmacy. In other words, it would be the duty of the Board of Pharmacy to make sure that the state law is met.
They can't do that because the federal laws do not ask for the same things I do. We ask for 12 extra things that the HEW forms do.
From your point of view, I don't think you're right. I think that the procedure that they are outlining here in the body tied into the law would say that the form approved would have to be as stringent, would have to require the same conditions as the one the Board of Pharmacy promulgates. And it's simply a question of having an alternate form that meets all of those things.
And you don't get my point. The Board of Pharmacy cannot ask anything, regardless of the rules they have. They cannot ask anything if you don't have it in the law.
That's the point. The proposed amendment was to add these words: providing such form meets the requirements of Chapter 475. Now, if we put those.
What is Chapter?
That's your idea.
That's
the law. That's
the law. I mean, they're not setting aside anything in the law.
No. As long as the new requirements, as Chapter 475.
In other words, it would be like 631, except the except
that the Board of Pharmacy would approve for you to use the state of Vermont?
You know, when you had that first meeting, you had two forms. One was in Marcus form and one was
in the state form.
Yes. I didn't make them myself, frankly.
Well, the doctors had trouble with the state form, and they found that the Marcus format makes it easier for them to explain things to the patient. So that's the only difference we're talking about here. They would draw up that Marcus format, send it into the Board of Pharmacy, and the Board of Pharmacy would make sure that all of the things that were supposed to be in there were in there. So it would just be the way that it looked. And we feel that a narrative format explains it better to the patient and makes them better able to make a decision about whether they want
it. So what would you do about giving the names of the prescribing physician?
And that would be included.
You would just add that.
Yeah, add that to it.
Yes, that would be included.
Maybe it's required by the state law.
Give people a choice between doing that or using a regular state form.
That's correct. It's the same thing. End up with the same result. And they say that that's the only objection they would say are taking to the bill. But I see, and the rest of it would just go the way it is. Sounds like a prison deal.
Well, I think Mr. Brady has become highly suspicious.
Because you see what they're doing is that they have a lot of protocol and all, but the GAO report from 1976 points out they have all these wonderful rules, but they are not following this protocol, and people are dying, and people are not having adverse effects, and so on and so forth. So I know this works. I don't know what
we're often dealing with the unknown, Mr. Brady. It does seem to me, and I think to the members of the committee, that you're not losing anything, and you're just simplifying the procedure.
And I'll tell you one place that you didn't follow the instructions in the form you filled out, and that is that you did not use low language. And this is very important to people, that they be told things in their own language rather than using a disease.
Okay, let's just kind of down, and I think we're ready to vote on this now and see if you will come in and.
I think what I should do is, how do you feel? Do you all feel that this would be all right?
What I'm going to suggest is that I think putting Chairman to remove the amendment, but what I would hope that if we would hang on the bill to the next meeting, so you had a chance to look at it and talk with your husband and think about it.
Yes, but I feel that this is very unfair. I didn't bring anything.
If you're clear about it, let us know.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll act on it today, and our next meeting is tomorrow, so you can come back to us 1 o'clock tomorrow and let us know. But we'll act on it as soon as we get Senator Brown in here. Is there any objection? Let's go to 13 now.
They should be on page 1 of your sheet of amendments here.
They're going to finish this one up.
and see where we are. On page 2, line 5, after the period in search, if no guardian has been appointed, the available relative in the order listed in subsection 2 of this section solely may provide the written consent required by subsection 2 of this section for the adult patient. Now, is there any objection? Hearing none, so either, okay?
In line 7, delete may be and delete who is unable to give informed consent and insert with informed consent given.
I don't know if that's enough.
Anybody to agree to that?
I've agreed to this.
Is that correct? I believe they've agreed to all of these amendments.
I believe that we don't get us the rest of them.
In line 8, after section insert shall be administered.
Okay.
On page 3, line 5, delete or device.
Is that it?
That's it on the amendments proposed by Senator Burbidge.
So is there any objection? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Is that the third one?
There is an amendment submitted at the public testimony section hearing on this bill from the Portland Retail Druggist Association, which is the third one in this package, dated May 2nd, 1979. After line 11, page 1, I assume.
I don't think anyone here is interested in broadening this bill. Let's not even take the title.
Yeah. That would limit the liability of a pharmacy.
Okay, and is there anything else? Is that good?
There was an amendment which I haven't heard anybody proposed, which would transfer it from the Board of Pharmacy to the medical examiners, but nobody has seemed to champion that. It was championed in the Health Education Welfare Committee.
Okay, well, we'll leave it to where it is.
And I assume that the amendments that OMA and the medical school were proposing, which are listed as page 2 of this package, Legislative Council SB 640-3, which would in effect have allowed the hospitals to simply use their institutional review committees and bypass the Reagan law has been withdrawn
from the top. Okay. So we got the bill in time to go out now if we can get another vote.
Well, I think I'd like Mr. Brady to think about this.
Yeah, well, we can't, we probably won't pick it up till tomorrow anyhow. And let us know, Mr. Brady, if you see any problems tomorrow. But I think that I don't see her pull at all, and they're not opposing it apparently anymore, so looks like smooth sailing. All right.
Whether it is true, I wonder if the word alone instead of solely would read any better. The guardian solely, the guardian alone may provide.
Pardon?
Would it read better?
Yeah, that's fine. That's the sense of the committee. All right. We declare the office a part of the committee room. okay, we're going to go on to 8. I don't know if I ever thought of that before, Bob.
It's a bad idea.
Yeah. You took you? Yeah, but do it. You started like a dispenser, the back line, the eyes, the eyes, the eyes, the eyes, the okay. So the notice, Madam Secretary, that the members continue to be in attendance even if they're out there on the telephone. Let me get some votes. Okay.
Fan asked the remember since he was a lawyer.
That was very good to show up, Congress.
There are two basic problems addressed in 18. The first, the reason that both witnesses here, the thing that both witnesses would like to address has to do with the uniform attorney fees provision of this bill. And basically, it makes attorney fees a provision of the cost bill. And you wouldn't have to fight about attorney fees unless somebody objected. And Mr. Hammond has proposed extensive amendments with respect to that provision of this bill. The other provision, which hopefully we'll get to, is a provision which provides for attorney fees in habeas corpus appeal, which I don't believe Mr. Hammond or Mr. Eichel is expressing an interest in.
Well,
you want to go ahead? I'll talk to you from that, by way of amendment.
We should go ahead and make his suggestion, because I have some amendments to propose, but other than sort of conforming type amendments, making some minor changes in various other ORS provisions, I'm satisfied with the bill as conceived, and Bruce has a different conception of what tradition is not so.
How do you feel about his proposal?
I, when I approached the problem and drafting this bill, it was with a fairly narrow problem, and that was where we had prevailed in case on a murder. And although the provision involved seemed to suggest that attorney fees only could be recovered if you had pleaded and proven as part of a case in chief, your right to those attorney fees, we still were a prevailing party under the statute and should have been able to recover them. So we had no choice except to go ahead and include them in the cost bill, even though that may not have been correct. And the court went ahead and awarded them to us and we recovered them and never went up on appeal. But it was out of that concern that there are instances under the existing system where it seems uncertain as to how you recover attorney fees that I began the whole process. And then after running across various references from Justice Chief Justice Kennedy concerning the need for a comprehensive bill because it shows up on appeal all the time, I came up with the idea. And the idea was simply to treat all claims for attorney fees as something that is resolved after trial as part of a cost bill dispute if it comes to that. And by simply stating in the bill that any claim for attorney fees, however authorized by law, will come as part of a cost bill, and then making amendments in the existing cost bill provision, I thought I accomplished what I set out to accomplish. Some of what Bruce has suggested, one thing in particular is basically a change in Oregon law. I don't know if it's worth worrying about or even doing as he approached it, and that is to start making a distinction between costs and attorney fees, as it exists in the 1862 enactment. Attorney fees were costs, but they were a very narrowly prescribed amount. And under Bruce's conception, you could not get costs and attorney fees. You get the additional real amount of attorney fees only if there was some authorization for it. Otherwise, you would only recover costs. That's not how current Oregon law works. You can recover costs and attorney fees. His proposal is that you would make that distinction and you couldn't get both. I don't really care, but I don't know if the change is necessary.
Well, you tell us up here for sure.
I think each one of you should have a copy of the amendment. What I'm proposing is just a substitution. The bulk of 813 is is in this bill in section 16 and 17, if I recall.
Which one of the copies are you talking about?
This one, which is the one in your writing. The other is sort of a detailed explaining why I did it and what the case law is and so on. I think maybe I can explain why I'm proposing a substitution by picking out one little piece of language in the current version of 813 on page 1 of the printed bill on line 9. The words as authorized by law are added to the current cost bill statute. And the reason why on page 1 of my amendment I have a series of definitions is because of the ambiguity of that phrase as authorized by law. Attorney fees are authorized by law when they're authorized by statute, which we clearly want to include in this uniform procedure. When they're authorized by contract, which we want to include in this procedure, and when they're authorized by some rule of law, such as the inherent power of equity to award attorney fees. But there are some cases when I think it's clearly inappropriate to use this procedure. And so I have excluded those in some of my provisions. A key example is divorce cases. The Oregon Supreme Court has clearly held that the attorney's fees are right in there as part of the property settlement. If one party gets two-thirds of the property, then the other party may be entitled to attorney's fees. But if the split is more even, 50-50, then both parties may be required to pay their own attorney's fees. That's something that's going to have to be handled at the same time you're coming up with the decree. You don't want to handle that as a cost bill later on and have to make that determination, go back and look at the decree. The other key difference between the original version of 813 and mine are pleading rules. Handling it as a cost bill would seem to solve the problem. I think people are entitled at least to know the attorney's fees are being demanded. I don't think it's necessary to specify an amount, but I think a complaint should say that the party is requesting reasonable attorney fees, so that the other party can take it into account as far as settlement negotiations. I could go through and spend quite a bit more time going through each individual section, but if frankly, if no one's willing to substitute my version for the original, then there's not a lot of point in discussing the individual provisions.
Anyone has any very strong feelings on this?
In response to the 2 points of Bruce's, you know, I don't know about it. The board setting whether a later claim for attorney fees and the cost bill is a problem one way or the other. Of course, the Supreme Court's going to say, as it has in many instances, under existing law, attorney fees become part of the judgment because that's the way they've been told in effect by existing legislation is part of the judgment. If in fact you make a claim for attorney fees at the cost bill proceeding, if the court does not think it appropriate that you make that you have that recovery based on the judgment that's already been given and the decree that embodies the result the court thinks appropriate, you won't get attorney fees. So I don't think there's any reason why it cannot still be part of the cost bill. It's just a matter of form as opposed to substance, and I don't see any great need to distinguish between divorce settings and any other setting where you're asking for attorney fees. In terms of the requirement that you make a statement and request for attorney fees before they're awarded, under existing Oregon law, you cannot recover at judgment what you haven't requested to begin with. And that's why people uniformly in complaints when you ask for general or special damages also ask for costs and disbursements. We are now making a distinction, or 813 makes a distinction between attorney fees, costs, and disbursements. And although the procedure is the same in terms of how they're awarded as a process after trial, you must have asked for attorney fees where that is necessary to make the award possible at judgment, just in the same manner you must ask for costs and disbursement. You're entitled to them by law, but if you have a complaint that doesn't say, I want costs, disbursements, and attorney fees, you won't get attorney fees, just as you won't get costs, even though the statute, in fact, would have allowed them had you made the request. My problem with Bruce is, though, and we've discussed at some length, is that he would leave out, he talks about pleadings as being complaints, answers, responses, and petitions, or whatever. There are, and excluding motions, presumably excluding murders.
Yes.
I guess in FED setting, people appear without filing anything. The way Bruce and Bill is drafted, I think there'll be instances where people will start disputing whether you were required to file a pleading that now makes it a dispute whether you're going to recover attorney fees. My bill totally avoided that issue, letting existing law concerning when requests have to be made for attorney fees be treated in the same manner as requests for costs and disbursement. And I have no problems with the existing law, and it would simply treat attorney fees in the same way. So I just don't think, while I began with some of the same questions Bruce began with and made a number of drafts to a bill, I finally came down to what I thought was a very clean and straightforward proposal, which accomplishes everything that needs to be accomplished without unduly complicating the law and worrying about other interrelationships which may in fact be created by new provisions which are enacted, some of Bruce's provisions which might be enacted.
Is this a suggestion, is this, the law is, as you see the law, it provides if you don't ask for attorney fees, even in a tenant case or any case, if you don't ask for attorney fees in your complaint, that you can't get attorney fees as a part of your cost at all.
That if you don't ask for some relief, you may not get that relief. If you don't ask for costs in a plea, you presumably will not get costs or disbursement.
What if attorney fees I don't know if the Supreme Court is clear on this yet. Sometimes they say that you ask for attorney fees as part of the cost bill, and sometimes it's something else.
That's because it's assumed the legislature wanted that distinction. When dealing with contracts, they have assumed that the contract provision is intended to be part of the cause of action, not part of the cost bill. And they've gotten into great struggles with the language that's used, whether the legislature said in addition to cost and disbursement or as part of cost and disbursement. The proposal which I had in 813 is simply they're all cost and disbursement. They're all treated after the case has been resolved on the merits, and your right to them is determined as authorized by law, whether it's under some other principle, whether it's by statute, whether it's by rule, whatever. If there is legal authority from the word of attorney fees, you make the process required that you do it in a cost bill.
And so we have another bill before this committee that we heard yesterday, supported by legal aid and opposed by collection agencies. The question of whether the attorney fee was a part, and I guess also when Senator Gardner was signed on that bill, the question of whether the attorney fee would be considered as a part of the contract or its cost. And so your bill might be argued to have the effect of removing the attorney fee section of that contract from the jurisdictional amount.
Yes, yes.
That's your intended effect?
Yes, it's consistent with what I proposed. I thought the approach that legal aid was taking was sort of a backwards way to accomplish their purpose. but
it's a straightforward way to attack the
No, it looks like nothing to do with their situation. It changes the, and this gets back to why I don't think there's any constitutional right to a jury trial on any of these issues. It simply says that your claim for attorney fees can be based on any source you can find, but we're going to characterize that as a cost of the litigation, and you'll have to come in and establish your right to that if the other side disputes it in the cost.
Would this require, let's say we're talking about a divorce, would this require a second hearing? Or are you saying you're going back into the ante room again?
All right.
Well, it's going to be a part of the hearing room, kind of about.
The only danger of using that as a prior hearing room, and maybe the unanimous consent motion adopted,
then you may go out there about it.
I had a letter yesterday from Sam Wire. He said, the phone booth is all full of fat and all women, but there's five of them.
Okay.
All right. I'm not familiar with divorce practice.
All right, now I got to answer your question.
And that is, under either Mr. Armstrong's bill or my bill, there would not be any need for a second hearing on attorney's fees unless someone objected. My point is that in virtually every divorce case, someone is going to object to an allowance for attorney's fees. You're going to have a hearing, therefore you might as well have the hearing at the same time you're considering the decree.
And what I don't know is if costs and disbursements, for example, at the resolution of the dispute are also embodied in the decree. So in fact, the costs and disbursements provisions that already exist under Chapter 20 do not apply to divorce decrees already. I don't know that. It may well be that divorce decrees automatically incorporate everything to begin with. And there is no second hearing at any time in a divorce setting. In which case, my law, basically my bill doesn't change anything except for providing this procedure wherever you request attorney fees, just like whenever you request cost and disbursement, it's done after trial. Where cost and disbursements are done during trial, they'll also be done during trial as it exists, where 20,
whatever.
Where 2210 doesn't apply now, 2210 won't apply later.
Isn't your intention to provide that all that attorney's fees shall always be treated as a part of the cost bill?
To the extent that costs are treated as part of the cost bill, and to the extent disbursements are part of the cost bill.
So it's your intention that there'll be one procedure. There's only one way, really, technically, only one way to get attorney's fees, and that's as a part of the cost bill.
Right.
And so that would apply in the case of a divorce as well.
Assuming that it currently applies in the case of a divorce.
Well, how do you mean?
I do not know if in divorce proceedings, when they frame the final decree, they also have determined costs and disbursements in framing that decree. And in fact, there is not a separate hearing in divorce which establishes costs and disbursements, but it's done at the same time as the decree. And if that's the case, then attorney fees would be treated in the same manner. If in fact courts now in the divorce setting have a decree which says we'll divide the property this way and custody of the children be determined in some other way, and you can submit a cost bill, and if you dispute it, we'll end up litigating that as a second phase of this litigation. I don't know if divorce decrees in effect already have homogenized the process, in which case attorney fees will be treated in the same way as costs and disbursements, in those divorce settings. I don't know the answer to the question.
Mr. Chairman, when I did inform you, you said both of them, there is a requirement.
In both cases, in divorce,
and you said, no, in separation trial, frequently the court will declare the amount of attorney's fees at the time the decree is rendered, but in other instances, if there are some reason to look back on the amount of time involved or something like that, there may be a subsequent hearing or exchange of letters as a result of which the order is so it varies in court practice. It's not treated as it is in actions of law in which you've got to go through the process of filing the cost.
And this will not change that to the extent that cost and disbursement now can be incorporated in the decree, even though there is a provision for the maintenance of cost and disbursement for awarding and it's always done after judgment. I assume attorney fees in that same setting, if that's what he's asking in divorce and separation proceedings, this isn't designed to change the existing practice.
So what you're saying, I think I understand now, is the key question is when it's cost to determine whether they're determined at the time of trial, as sometimes is done with a divorce, or whether they may be determined at a subsequent time with the filing of the cost bill. But in any event, the effect that you're seeking for your bill would be that the determination of attorney's fees would be ruled at the same time as cost and disbursement. And your proposal, which is in the bill, you haven't offered any proposed amendments to.
I've got two amendments which I added, which came to mind a few weeks ago. One was to amend ORF 17055, and the other was to amend 20.180, and I've got copies of those. Basically, all it does is change the existing provisions that you offer to compromise at trial, or in an action for money damage agreement, if the defendant makes a tender offer before trial and then brings the amount to court, and the defendant doesn't recover more than that amount. Existing law states that costs and disbursements will be recovered by defendants rather than plaintiffs, but it does not deal with attorney fees. So this is basically not really related to my bill at all, but it brings some conformity to existing law because conceivably you would have situations even under existing law where someone would come in and say, well, I'm the prevailing party because I have a judgment in a contract action which gives me money. And therefore, while I may not be entitled to cost or disbursement, because you came in the court beforehand and offered the amount that I ultimately recovered, I can still recover attorney fees. This would simply say, if you can't get cost and disbursement, you also can't get attorney fees. And the other side probably is entitled to them because, in effect, we're characterizing them as a prevailing party. So this is just designed to make Oregon law consistent with what current practice should reflect in it. And with the focus to at the same time that the uniform attorney fee provisions are enacted. And in brief, he has the same type of conforming amendments to other existing sections, primarily chapter 20, which I would recommend to the committee as well. But since they, in all instances that we talk about cost and disbursement, also talk about attorney fees as a uniform process.
And you tell me now, it just came to my mind that it seems to me, Judge Beatty, I'd like you to comment on this. If it's your understanding of the law,
if you're only selling the same as mine, that will have a bodily property tort claim less than $1,000. So a written criminal demand is made, and the money is not paid within that 10 days upon the filing of the action. But you're entitled to the attorney's fees, even though the day after you file, or the day after they serve, they come in and say, "Where's the money?" That's what I think the state of the law is there. Now, that's unlike, I believe it's under the law relating to attorney's fees under first party in an insurance contract. I think there that it's something like, I think it ties into it by style, and depending on in some cases, if they come in before you file, even though maybe 3 months later, and so I think they can defeat their attorney's fees. They're like in contract, I
suspect. I think they can defeat the right to attorney's fees in insurance cases right up to the moment the judgment is ordered.
Now, you got any case law? I thought it was the other way. I don't be understanding that once you file, if you're given a 10-day notice, and they didn't pay you, and you're entitled to those attorney's fees, you
write. I'm not talking about the 10-day notice, I'm talking about the 6 months.
You write about the 10-day notice, and the way 17855 is currently devised, if they come in and offer to confess judgment, the confession and judgment will in turn award you attorney fees. 17855 now only kicks in if they refuse the offer of confession, and instead it goes to trial, and you only get the amount that they offer to pay you at that point. So you would get attorney fees even if they came in a day later. But only if you accept the confession of judgment. If you renounce it and say, "No, I'm going to go to trial because you only offered me $500 and I'm asking for $990 and I think I can get it." If you only recover $500, it turns around and you would get your attorney fees for opposing your claim of more than you were offering to pay. That's the present law. That's the present law. And this doesn't change. You say, well,
if you put a question made on record, I don't want my I wouldn't venture to, I simply wouldn't venture an opinion on the effect of these things because I haven't read the, documents. And also, my experience with trying to figure out when attorney's fees get activated, you have to look at each one of the statutes to refresh your recollection. And I would suggest that the court committee passed on it that you have to have. Collect all of the relevant sections dealing with attorney's fees and look exactly at that.
I asked him at the judgment to have printed out through the Oregon, I guess whatever that research company is, ORIC, the number of sections where it's mentioned, and that's how many times it's mentioned in ORIC. I think they're 83 references, and I stopped going through them after a while. So you can spend a long time, and that's why I got, no, excuse me, 408 references. And that's why I stopped trying to draft the provision that reflected everything in the existing Oregon law and worried about it. And instead, simply said, it's always going to be part of that stuff. And your claims for attorney fees can be identified under some existing provision, and we don't care how that characterized it, you can do it only under this one procedure. Has the state bar ever had a committee study this proposed bill? Which I don't know what happened to it. I attended a convention, but I don't remember hearing the bill discussed. It did propose the bill, and I have a copy of that as well, which may have been introduced for all I know.
No, it wasn't.
Apparently it may not have been approved by the committee then, or by the convention.
that it has the problems with guys trying to get you, but primarily the concern with the jury trial, right? Again, based again with an assumption which I think is being unsound, and that is that someone could make the claims to a likely jury trial after we have already decided to characterize this as cost and not subject to the, not part of your cause of action. I did some research after the last committee meeting and expert and made copies of cases, Oregon cases, the one that they mentioned in some of the prior cases. And basically, they simply reflect a very obvious proposition, and that is, if your claim for attorney fees is part of your cause of action, then of course, your whole cause of action goes to the jury, and the jury makes the decision concerning your right to recover them and the amount you're recovered, whether they're reasonable or not. And by that strict testimony, you go through the whole process. If it is not part of your cause of action, which virtually all attorney fees are not, except for the one provision quoted and interpreted concerning contracts, then there's no jury trial to begin with. It's simply not involved at all. And by making this all part of the cost of the system, we've eliminated any claims for jury trial. And there are many instances under existing procedure for attorney fees where they are part of cost, where you'll have fact questions which someone will have to decide, and it's the court. And no one has suggested yet that a jury would be called back to make these decisions. For example, the $1,000 figure which you mentioned, you have to make that demand 10 days before. That's a fact question. It's determined by the judge in a cost debate. And all we're saying is it's always going to be done by the judge in a cost debate.
What do you think, Judge Beatty? Do you think there may be some pitfalls and some cost holes out there somewhere on a general bill like this, or we might, if we pass it, we might do something we didn't intend to do?
Well, I think the concept is appealing. As I listened, I was just trying to think of how this is actually going to work out. Now, in most instances, at least in the practice of circuit court, where someone, for one reason or another, is entitled to recover costs, usually there is a stipulation which is pretty no expert testimony would be required when the court calls for it. The prevailing party will submit a claim for time and effort expended to serve the copies, and then if anyone wants to be heard, why you hold a hearing. Otherwise, you simply send a letter announcing what's been covered. Now, this process, as I understand it, supposes that you will simply serve a claim for attorney fees as a part of your cost. I would suppose that you or I will be the prevailing party would place that fee at least at the upper end of what we thought we might be awarded in order not to run the risk of not getting as much as you thought the court might award. And the other side would probably come back setting the cost bill down for argument. And then you would automatically perhaps have a hearing in every case.
I think the same stipulation process that you usually follow would be equally available here.
You would either, in the absence of a stipulation, you would have an argument in every case, which meant a hearing on cost bill. I suppose now we have a hearing on cost bill in the circuit court only for once every 10 cases.
But
again, I'm not changing the when attorney fees can be awarded. So, in effect, in all instances where attorney fees are now disputed, you're having these disputes as part of cost bill, you're setting contract action anyway. The only thing this bill changes is, in practical terms, is the current treatment of 20.096 and 097, which involves contract claims, where the court has interpreted the legislative intent to say that's part of your cause of action. Therefore, you get a jury trial and you make a pleading upon. Those are the only cases that are practically affected by this under existing law. The fact that the court can still be engaged in these disputes is the primary reason why I proposed the bill. Because while I'm fairly confident almost most instances now, you could argue effectively that the legislature intended the attorney fees and all these other narrow little statutes to be part of cost. The court still occasionally will say no, the legislature intended that they be part of the cause of action, and therefore they do it during the trial rather than in the cost.
Okay. Here's what I think that, I don't know. The way I feel about it, the more testimony I hear, the more complex the problem seems to be. And I don't know if I'm going to resolve it today, and I have a kind of a feeling that this is something that we perhaps could talk to the bar about, or there's a possibility that the judiciary committee in the interim probably something that interests lawyers, I'm sure, and I think nothing that interests lawyers more than the fees, I wouldn't think. That being said, I think we have to, I don't think, let's not carry this thing on anymore every day. For example, the way I feel about it, I think that you ought to talk to the bar about maybe conducting a comprehensive study of this whole question of allowance of attorneys to maybe a bar committee, and or maybe if we have a interim committee, maybe study it on anyway.
Just a quick comment on that. The Council on Court Procedures has this question on its agenda for the next biennium, whether it just did or not, I can't say, but they do intend to take it out and draft a rule that would be part of the rules and court procedures.
My only concern is showing us the extending this in the next legislative session is that Judge is going to be 5 years ago asked for a uniform bailiff, but and then this last year we asked for a uniform bailiff. It's been a recurrent problem, and one reported volume of like 2 cases on attorney fee disputes, solely because there wasn't such a bill. And I drafted this bill with the cleanest, least amount of change possible.
I will check with Judge Dale tomorrow morning to discuss the question with him. I personally asked him to canvass. If this falls in the scope of the Council on Court Procedures, then it ought to be handled by them. It shouldn't be picked out. And it may be that that's the realistic way to handle it, because they can take the material that's been offered and then at the same time check its impact on other aspects of the procedure. But I'll ask Jeff Dale about it and report back to you tomorrow.
It seems to me this is one of those cases, it may be a very simple problem, but sometimes it looks so simple and you have all sorts of side effects. And that's why we run off all these others. We have this bill in early, just to treat it automatically, I hope, by now, about simplifying and eliminating the requirements for notaries. And there's just all kinds of pitfalls out there and things, and so we finally just forgot about it. And I guess it's all there in the table. And I think this maybe, and Doug, I think that would be a good idea. And maybe that, I'm inclined to think that's the way I deal with it.
Did you have any?
Just a mini question. In the contract situation, how does that, that procedure, how is that handled by the statute that you proposed? Like, it's really outside the statute. No, I don't see you as saying that's authorized by law and accepted between the contract.
Well, contracts are decoded as well. And right now, under 2196, that you're entitled to attorney fees if the contract provides it, no matter whether the contract is enforced by statute. And
there's a card, there's a statute provided.
Yeah,
it's permission.
Yes.
To be included in the contract.
Yes, and the award is based on the fact that you agree in your contract to permit attorney fees.
So basically, you're changing the Supreme Court rule, which is based upon the statutory rule.
The court has simply said in the past that it wasn't 2096 and 2097. Your claims for attorney fees under the contract were simply part of the cause of action.
Right.
And we're saying, fine, we're not treating it now as part of the cause of action, we're treating it as a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And we're changing the statute.
Right.
Okay. Here's what, I think that saves us that bill for now. And
set half of that bill that you said we did.
Well, there is another section, the Habeas Corpus section. Can you give me a draft, I believe? I've had a draft of the more comprehensive Habeas Corpus bill, which is fine as proposed. I have one recommendation, but that I can pass on to you, and I have no problem with deleting the Habeas Corpus provision from any bill. Assuming a bill would have been passed.
Now, do you have a separate Habeas Corpus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If I might just give a little background here.
So is there another number bill, or do you just have a proposal to be included here?
The House bill, which is House Bill 2198, which the House Judiciary Committee has just referred to Ways and Means, which a copy has been included in this folder. We have a draft from Legislative Council, which is draft number 2686, which also should be in the folder. And two other questions. I might add that January 12th letter due to me from Chief Justice Jennifer raised this problem, and you asked me to draft a bill, which is now draft number 2686 from Legislative Council. Unbeknownst to us, there were these other two things in the works. Now, the three approaches are indeed three different approaches to this problem. Senate Bill 813 very simply amends the post-conviction relief statute and says that with respect to appeal, if the petitioner is indigent, the court shall appoint and pay for appointed counsel. And that would go to all of these, require the county to pay. The county of the
region of the... Let me stop you right there. There's only two of us here today. As far as I'm concerned, unless we reactivate it, that we're going to work, I think we ought to look at the attorney fees bills in a more long range aspect. However, we have this bill, which we might be able to use as a vehicle for the habeas corpus. It actually does deal with habeas corpus. It's 5 minutes till 3. I have to be at a committee meeting at 3 o'clock when I want to attend. And we only have two members. So what I think we will do, what is it we have scheduled for the first big bill for tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, we have Senator Gardner
antitrust.
Let's find out, first of all, if Senator Gardner is going to be here at 1 o'clock.
He won't be.
Tomorrow?
He will not be.
Well, then let's pick that one off. We'll pick that one off. He's there at all?
No, he's going to be at another meeting.
Okay, so we will pick the antitrust bill off. And let's carry over this bill, and let's talk about the habeas corpus aspect together with the other bills that we had on schedule for today. We'll carry these over, and then there's one of some other dogs and cats, the other bills that we had scheduled along with the antitrust bill, didn't we, Diana? And I'll find out when we won't schedule the antitrust bill until we know that Senator Gardner will be able to be here. So
I normally would defer to you because never practiced in civilian life and never really cut you about trade speed or the California bar. But it seems to me that the proposal to reform an 813 is so very small that, with exception of the habeas corpus aspect of the census, it could go through by itself. So I don't have trouble with it. I know you may, but you also have good experience in doing that.
Well, I'm concerned about the things that how it might affect the substance of what we think of as substantive rights to attorney fees.
Well, I don't think you can even discuss it, except to say, except as provided by law.
Well, we can certainly talk about it later, but I'd have some concern, at least, and I am. So far, the philosophy is generally when in doubt, do nothing. And I think that's generally a pretty straight proposition, if I don't really know what the effect of it's going to be. I have reasonable belief. I mean, I think it's better to leave the mess the way it is. Why don't we, I think we will adjourn, we'll meet tomorrow at 1 o'clock.